Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.
Hello, good evening and welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Good evening, John.
Good evening, Ben, and hi, everybody.
Hi, indeed. As ever, our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032. Yes, that's 087-179-1032, and normally catch us on the live on the internet at dublincityfm.ie, but unfortunately, the website is currently down. It's been rejigged, for want of a better word, and thank you to our texter, who I think is a gentleman in Tala, if I'm not mistaken, regarding access or lack of access to the program. In fact, all the programs here on 103.2 Dublin City FM on the via the website.
It's going to be good, though. Down.
Well, we're promised a good website, so hopefully it will be worth the disruption. But we shall see. But anyway, we have lots to get through. I don't know where we get. We have a lot of topics to get through, John. Hopefully we get through most of them. Normally we run out of time, we've just so much to talk about, but we never get there. But let's go straight into what to see in the night sky.
Yeah, coming up shortly indeed, July the 6th, where are we now, the 2nd?
The 1st.
1st?
Isn't it the 1st? Am I running away with myself?
It's the 1st, yeah.
It is.
Yeah, there you go, good stuff. 6th of July until July the 23rd, we're going to have the International Space Station back in the evening skies. Seemed like an eternity before that came back in as well. And that's well worth watching. It comes in, if you're pointing south, quite high up from the west, sort of southwest direction. And when it says it's coming in at whatever time it comes in, it comes in at whatever time it comes in. So I don't have the time for that one for a few days' time, but you can Google it quite easily and find out when it's going to hit our evening skies. Mercury, fortunately, is fading and starting to sink back down into the glow of sunset. Venus, brilliant, at a magnitude of minus 4.2. It's always been bright and has been for the last 6 months, even though there's quite a crescenty type of surface view of the sun shining on it. It rises above the east to northeast horizon about half an hour just before the first glimmer of dawn, and Venus climbs higher until the dawn sky grows too bright for it, of course. And in a telescope, Venus's shrinking globe, now only about 18 arc seconds pole to pole, has become gibbous at 63%, so it's quite, I won't say half lit, but a little bit more than half lit. I was just saying earlier on, Ben, I'm losing the way around the sky at the moment, because we had it so good for so long with all the planets in a row, all six or seven or eight or nearly nine, I suppose.
We're not going to talk about Pluto.
And I was out a couple of nights over the weekend and out for a good while, actually, just trying to spot things. And I'm watching, if you stand out long enough, the plough is there, and Cassiopeia sort of comes right round, and I guess a little bit higher into the darkness as well, so you can see Andromeda as well, because it comes in quite low in the first part of the evening. Mars is drawing farther away from Regulus, low in the west, and it right after dusk. They were 6 degrees apart on Friday the 27th, and they're widening out to 10 degrees by July the 4th, which is only 3 days' time. In a telescope, Mars is just a tiny shimmering blob, a mere 5 arc seconds wide. So it says don't bother. That's what it's saying. It's quite hard to find bits and pieces around the sky just at the moment. Jupiter remains out of sight. It's in conjunction with the Sun. Saturn is magnitude plus 0.1 at the border of Aquarius. And the best time to try with a telescope on Saturn is just as dawn is beginning. Mm-hmm. I've never done dawn telescope viewings. Yeah, it's just
generally I don't do dawn at all.
Yep, and it's about 5 or 6 fists upper right of Venus. So Venus is very, very easy to see. Uranus is unobservably low as dawn begins. And Neptune, one of these days this word is going to disappear, the telescopic star at a magnitude 7.9, extremely difficult to see. And it's in Saturn's background, just 1 degree from it, and catches this outermost major planet just before the dawn begins. So, as I say, there's nothing much happening up there just at the moment. And it happens so quickly. They all just disappear.
Yes, John, thank you for that. We have, of course, the moon, currently a 41% waxing crescent moon, is currently above the horizon, but it's rather cloudy, at least it was on the way into the studio here this evening. And it will set just after midnight tonight, in fact, about 20 minutes to 1 tomorrow morning. That's the Dublin time for it to set. The further west you are, of course, the later it will set. And the moon will rise again tomorrow on the 2nd of July at 1:32 p.m., by which time it will have grown to a 48% waxing crescent phase as we head towards the first quarter moon, which is also tomorrow at 8:30 p.m. And then we have the sunrise in Dublin tomorrow at 5:02 a.m., which is 4 minutes later than this day last week. And local Newman, the sun is at its highest and due south. That's at 1:29 p.m. Sunset tomorrow, 9:55 p.m., which is 2 minutes earlier.
Yeah.
Not quite a grand contraction. 2 minutes earlier than a week ago. And then we will have a civil twilight until 10:46 p.m., nautical twilight then until 14 minutes past midnight. So just technically speaking into Thursday morning. And then we'll have astronomical twilight for about 2.5 hours again until we get back to nautical twilight. So no astronomical night until around the 30th of July. That means we're going to have 6.5 minutes less daylight than a week ago. So that's a bit of a contraction. You wouldn't really notice it at this stage, but that rate of change will increase. Tomorrow there'll be 1 minute and 17 seconds less daylight than today. When the time between sunrise and sunset will be 16 hours and 52 minutes. Don't forget, tomorrow, Wednesday, the 2nd in the evening, you have an opportunity, John, at 2300 hours UT. Oh, that's midnight, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. To see that lunar X and V effects. I don't know whether you've ever seen that. Basically, when the shadow is, it's hard to, I know some people in the IAS now, they've sent me some photographs, so they have caught it at the right time, and you can see this. It's just a way, on the terminator between the daytime and the nighttime side of the moon, you see this X. It's just the way the shadow falls and the shape of the mountains and the hills, and there's the Y, and there's the lunar snail. I don't know whether you've seen it. You need a bit of imagination to make out the snail, all right, but it is in the shape of the snail. and then, Thursday. That's the 3rd of July. Earth is at aphelion at 9 p.m. in the evening. And that means that the Earth and the Sun are at their furthest distance apart, would you believe it? When it will be 1.01664 astronomical units between the Earth and the Sun. One astronomical unit is the average distance between the Earth and the Sun. The Earth doesn't go around the Sun in a perfect circle, slightly elliptical, and at this time of the year we are actually further away from it than we are in the winter. And on Friday, do you think you might get up and have a look at Mercury? It's at its greatest elongation, and I think that's in the evening actually, but in the morning, if you're looking for Venus and Uranus, there's a good pointer. Uranus and Venus are 2.5 degrees apart, and they will be near the Pleiades, and it's still noctilucent cloud season, and we were just talking about that earlier. And I had some photographs from a WhatsApp group from the Irish Astronomical Society from around the country showing some magnificently beautiful electric blue clouds high in the sky just after sunset. They are amazing.
We better I suppose explain what noctilucent clouds are. They're quite high
Yes, they are very wispy cloud. They're higher than, I think they're approximately 80 kilometers or something. Really, really very high. Way beyond what commercial aircraft fly at.
Because they can't. It's just too high for them. Mm. Yeah, indeed. I have a book for you. New one, Michael Collins, Carrying the Fire is what it's called. And this is really about what happened when he was commanding the module when Neil and Buzz were on the moon in 1969. And he was about 97 kilometers away from the moon, which was so near but yet so far. I wonder what he felt. I don't know. If you were told that you weren't going to land, you were going to go but not land, what would your thoughts be if the other two lads got out and did their stuff?
Well, he was trained, I think, specifically for the command module. But there was, if I'm not mistaken now, there was one of the astronauts that went to the moon twice. Didn't land. But on the second, I think it was maybe on Apollo 8 or 9, not sure which, but on the second mission, I stand to be corrected now by one of our most common texters, but that, and he had the choice of being in command module or lunar module, and he went for the command module, which did I get that right? I'm going to do my research again.
I think you're probably right. I would need to use Google or something for that one. Anyway, there's a photograph that Michael Collins took, and remember Apollo 8 is when it just came round and pointed, and we got the Earth in the distance. Well, Michael got a picture of the capsule coming back off the moon surface with Buzz and Neil in it, and it's a nice sight as well. So that book again, Michael Collins, Carrying the Fire, and it's all about the bits and pieces that he did when he went up there as well. Not to actually land on the moon, but, you know, to get pretty close, 92 kilometers, which is pretty good. So,
thank you, John. And SpaceX in the news a lot lately. You can tell us your story about SpaceX in a moment, perhaps. But I see the Mexican president is threatening legal action with SpaceX over falling debris and contamination from the SpaceX rocket launches, which are near, but they're launched from southern Texas. The Mexican government say they are studying international laws and whether international law was violated in order to file the necessary lawsuits, because they say there is contamination. This was based on a story we covered last week, John. The SpaceX Starship rocket that exploded during a routine ground test at the Starbase headquarters of Mr. Musk's space project on the South Texas border, near the coast, or near the border with Mexico. And the explosion, you may have seen the video of it, sent a huge fireball into the air, and of course it was a bit of a setback to his progress, especially towards getting to people to Mars. But some of Mexican officials, they say they're carrying out a comprehensive review of the environmental impacts of the rocket launches. And the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration, again, a story which we covered in the last few weeks, have approved an increase of annual Starship rocket launches from 5 to 25, basically in the belief or stating that the increased frequency would not adversely affect the environment. There was a case taken to court about it because the environmental group said it was adversely affecting and endangering sea turtles and shorebirds. And I see back in May, the Mexican government said that it had sued Google for renaming the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America for Google Maps users in the United States, which was an executive order by Mr. President Donald Trump. So I was saying earlier, what becomes, well, you can call it whatever you like, but I was just wondering then, will the Irish Sea suddenly, will the British Parliament decide it's going to be called the English Sea, and the French government will rename the English Channel the French Channel? Who knows where it'll all end.
Yeah, indeed. And I did say that I would mention Richard and Paige in the Birmingham direction this evening, who said they would be listening in. So good evening to you guys. Thank you for tuning our way. We like to hear from people way, way further than that as well. So if you're around 087-179-1032, just to tell us where you're listening from, at what time it is over there as well. So thank you indeed for tuning, and we love to hear and see a few texts on our little system here as well. I have to talk about this, Ben.
Tell me.
The time for really going out to watch stars is after 11-ish and before sort of 3 o'clock in the morning. That's when, it doesn't get dark enough, and then it suddenly gets bright again because of the time of the year we're in. So I was out on Friday night and looked up. Okay, first thing I got was a fireball, an absolute beaut, just by total accident. And after that, I reckon it was about 1:15 in the morning on Friday into Saturday, I got to see my first Starlink system, if you want, of satellites. There's 27 Starlink satellites all in a row, and they were up in the sky for about 3 minutes, I reckon. I said, my goodness, that is some sight. So what I did was I Googled, yep, as we all do, and there are times for wherever you are. So you can, if you spot the Starlink, the Starlinks, we just call them the Starlinks, and on July the 1st, which was today, into the early hours of the morning, we had it at 1:26. They come around at 2:57. Again, the 3:05, 4:31. And tonight's ones, if you want to go out, 1:37 a.m. from tonight into tomorrow, Wednesday morning, 1:37 a.m. again. That's Starlink 276. Now, there is a 277 up there as well, so they're pretty close because they were launched pretty close to each other as well. So this is one of these things we're going to follow now, because that's the first time I've seen them, and they're absolutely magnificent. Not great for people who want to have a...
do an astrophotography, long exposure.
Things, yeah, because yeah. You get these streaks across the sky. But for me, the first time of seeing it, it came from the southwest up to the east. Started quite low at about 20 degrees, raised to about 55 degrees, and then back to about 11 degrees. So it was in the sky for a good long time. So the pass for tonight into tomorrow is 4 minutes, which is pretty good. So put that in the diary just for development, because there's loads of things to see up there still. Even though the planets have decided that they're not really visible at the moment, because most of them are under either the evening twilight or they're in the morning as well. So again, 1:37, Starlink 276 is the one that you'll see. An absolutely brilliant sight to see, I must say. 27 satellites all in one straight line.
Thank you, John. Now, why is the sun so good at evaporating water? Now, I was asked earlier by someone who should remain nameless, is that not a silly question? And you might think it is. You might think, well, heat is heat, and surely heat. If you know a little bit of basics about physics and chemistry and specific heat capacity and things like that, and how many calories or joules it takes to raise a volume of water by 1 degree. Of course, it depends on its starting temperature, but that's another story. But anyway, a new study has come up with some interesting revelations on why solar radiation is more effective than other forms of energy at causing water to evaporate. And apparently it comes down to, an oscillating electric field, which is inherent in sunlight itself. Now, you might think that's very high-tech and such like, but it has been well established that the sun is exceptionally good at causing water to evaporate, more so than a much more efficient way than just simply heating water on your cooker in a pot. And so to explore why, the group of students and other researchers in North Carolina State University, they ran some computer simulations, and they explained what was happening by saying that light is an electromagnetic wave, which consists in part of an oscillating electric field. And they found that if you remove the oscillating electric field from the equation, it takes longer for sunlight to evaporate water. So it's not just the amount, simply the amount of calories or heat that you put into it. But they said, but when the field is present, water evaporates very quickly, and the stronger the electric field, the faster the water evaporates, and the presence of this electric field is what separates light from heat when it comes to evaporating water. Now, you may be asking, what is that oscillating electric field doing? But apparently during evaporation, two things happen. Evaporation either frees individual water molecules, which drift away from the bulk of the liquid water, or it frees water clusters, where these water clusters are little small, finite groups of water molecules, which are connected to each other, but can be broken away from the rest of the water, even though they are still interconnected. And usually both of these things happen to varying degrees, but it's much more efficient at lobbing off the groups of molecules.
Now, that's
is that simple?
Physics, yeah.
That's physics and, mostly physics more than chemistry, yeah.
I'm still sort of a little bit interested in the physics as physics, but if you were to start, where would you start? What sort of area would you go into if you were... I know school physics is slightly different. It's all calculations and things, and not really for me all the sums and math and all that sort of stuff.
There's a bit of maths in it, but... Mm.
I must do a little survey and just see what's available if you were to start in the world of astrophysics. I'll ring me buddy Brian Cox, that's what I'll do.
I remember 20 years ago anyway, there were very few courses, certainly in astronomy here in Ireland, but now there are, usually combined with maths or astrophysics or some such. But, for all you budding students out there who want to be astronomers or astrophysicists, you can now study the subject now.
Yeah, a fascinating subject. I need to go back just to the asteroid 2024 YR4. This is the one that has the low risk of the moon impact in 2032. Originally, there was a thought that it might come our direction. We might have to just send something up and just give it a little bit of a nudge. But as well, so this particular one is just to keep you educated into the number of it. So it's asteroid 2024 with a YR4 on the end of it. It gained its attention after the discovery in late December 2024 when the automated systems indicated a small chance of the Earth impact in 2032. The probability briefly rose to 3%, prompting a global planetary defense response. That's it, just to send something up and just give it a little nudge. And by further observations, early 2025, which we're in now, and it eliminated the threat to Earth. And despite this reassurance, the moon is on the path. They reckon it still has a fairly small 4% probability of impacting the moon on the 22nd of December 2032. Why does it always pick Christmas and things like that? Huh? How do you program an asteroid or whatever it is to arrive just before Christmas? That's good. So the estimate is expected to remain unchanged until the asteroid becomes visible again in mid-2028 when astronomers will be able to refine its path. So it's all the calculations. There we go, back into astrophysics and all that sort of stuff to do that. So it's a big 60-meter-wide asteroid. And it was discovered at the Atlas Telescope in Rio Hurtado in Chile just 2 days after its closest approach to Earth. And I remember that one as well. So.
But I see on the same subject that ESA, they're planning a mission called NEOMIR, which is going to also look for asteroids on the way. And they say, I think it won't be launched now until the 2030s, but they're saying that if it had been up there now, it would have detected this asteroid about a month earlier. And that would give these astrophysicists and astronomers and mathematicians an extra month of data to plot its course and get a better, I suppose, view and a better accuracy of the chances of whether it would hit the Earth or the Moon. But as you mentioned, they have to wait another few years, is it? So it comes around again.
2028 is when they're going to do, calculate more accurately.
Whether the chances are or whether it will hit the moon or not.
Yeah, and whether we've got to do something against it just in case it decides to swing our direction as well.
Well, that's not likely to happen unless there's some major gravitational perturbation out there. But as we covered before, if it does, and if it does hit the moon on the near side, on a clear night.
Mm-hmm.
We'll can see it.
Yeah.
Well, that would be great. And if we knew exactly, because of that, so you probably will know exactly when it's going to, within the minute, if not the second of when it's going to hit, we could be all out ready and at the spot.
Mm-hmm.
June, focusing in on the spot where we think it'll hit. And that could cause such a huge crater and debris. And as we mentioned last week and the week before, that could send a lot of material towards the Earth, do a lot of damage to a lot of satellites in orbit, and cause millions of more pieces of space debris, which might even come down as meteor showers, or what would look like meteor showers. So that would be, from that point of view, would be that'd be very interesting.
Yeah. Now, just moving across to the NASA Mars Orbiter, it learns a few sneaky moves after 20 years in space. The orbiter is testing a series of large spacecraft rolls that will help it hunt for water on Mars as well. So after 20 years of operations, NASA's Reconnaissance Orbiter, the MRO, is on a roll, performing a new maneuver to squeeze even more science out of the busy spacecraft as it circles the red planet. So I think they had this planned for some time as well, so just to get on with the next thing, so they've, just in case they accidentally run out of things to look at and point at and things like that. So the new capability is detailed in a paper recently published in the Planetary Science Journal, documenting three very large rolls. So we'll keep an eye on this and keep you informed as to what has happened, because two of these were done in 2023 and 2024, but not much information is given out to ourselves out in Earth world, I suppose, other than being locked up away in NASA or somewhere. So we'll just keep an eye on that if we can.
Thanks, John. I see that astronomers over there in Heidelberg have found that Earth-sized planets are particularly prevalent around low-mass stars, which is according to new findings, according to this project. The study led to the discovery of four new exoplanets, and in fact it does offer compelling evidence that stars with less than one-sixth the mass of the Sun frequently host terrestrial worlds. So there were some observations done also in Spain, but they targeted M-dwarf stars with between one-tenth and one-half of the Sun's mass, and said these small stars dominate the galaxy in number and exhibit minute wobbles due to the gravitational pull of orbiting planets, which this system detects. Of course, the smaller the planet, or the less star, I should say, and the less massive it is, the more likely you're to see it tweak, wobble a bit due to a planet passing in front of it or around it. So they looked at 15 of these M-dwarf stars, and they one in particular had a mass about 14 times that of the Earth, and it circled its star every 3.3 Earth years. And they looked at some others, but they seem to be very close and orbit very quickly. But the main point is that smaller stars seem to have, they're more likely, it seems, to have Earth-like or rocky planets, as opposed to large gaseous planets like Uranus or Neptune.
Yeah, indeed.
Or Saturn.
Or Saturn even, yeah, indeed. Now, they reckon that desert lichen offers new evidence for the possibility of life on other planets. Now, how do they work this out? The question of whether Earth is alone in harbouring life has captivated humanity for millennia, and certainly with the new telescopes, the new one on Earth here, and the James Webb telescope taking pictures further out into space, the people in the know reckon that there definitely has to be life of some sort out in space as well. So they're looking at and studying desert lichen to see if Mars actually ever had any signs of life on the planet as well. Anyway, we're nearly just out of time, Ben, so we have to run off.
We have to run off, indeed. Thank you to Alan for his text. An article that we had hoped to cover about the US setting new record about the number of launches in June, but we never got around to that. But thank you, Alan, for that and your other messages. And indeed, yes, happy birthday to Debbie Harry, indeed. that's the wrong program you're taking on that one. But anyway, we leave it at that. But thank you very much, and thanks to John for your latest news. But that's all from me, Ben Emmett, for this edition of The Astronomy Show. Now it's music all the way here until 2 a.m. on 103.2 Dublin City FM, because up next we have Dublin's greatest hits, followed at 10 p.m. to midnight with Nigel Wood. He has his ear to the globe with his world music mix. And then from midnight until 2 a.m., Dave Barry, he has his mix of jazz, blues and soul with a program called After Hours. But please join myself and John at the same time, 7:30 p.m. next week. We'll be back with all the latest news from all corners and dimensions of the universe. Until then, take care of each other. Thank you for listening, and say goodnight, John.
Good night, John.
Good night, John.
Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.